DW Africa Link.
Happy New Year to you. The year 2025 has just begun, and only time will tell how different it will be from the previous year. However, several upcoming global events are bound to shake things up across Africa. Like the world's largest economy, the US, will swear in President-elect Donald Trump. And Germany, Europe's largest economy, will be voting for a new leader in February. So why should that matter to Africa? And how should the continent reposition itself in 2025 amid global challenges? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday, here on DW.
Overall, African economies struggled in 2024, but there is hope for a promising 2025. Ghana will unveil its new leader, John Mahama, early in January, with a hope that he can revamp the economy after the country suffered its worst economic setback in decades. We also wait to see how the aftermath of elections in Burundi, Tanzania, and Ivory Coast will contribute to the economic turnaround of the continent. However, it is crucial to acknowledge that significant global policy shifts and geopolitical tensions could pose a risk to Africa's economic strategy. Despite these challenges, there is potential for a positive economic shift in Africa this year. Let's dig into this with Tessa Dooms, sociologist, development practitioner, and political analyst. I also have here DW's correspondent in Accra, Ghana, Isaac Kaleji. Welcome to both of you. Tessa, incoming U.S. President Donald Trump has proposed imposing a 25% tariff on all products entering the U.S. from Canada and Mexico, and an additional 10% tariff on goods from China. He's also mentioned the possibility of tariffs on the European Union. Now, all this seems far from Africa, but how could the move impact Africa in any way?
Well, I think that what Donald Trump's signals are indicative of a potential trade war globally. And we've already seen Canada and Mexico's governments start to make threats of their own about how they would respond. And basically, this may impact on not just the cost of goods, but also the production value chains of goods from particular regions. And I think as we move into China particularly, the question about the global trading blocs and BRICS in particular comes into play, because China has more leverage than a country like Mexico or Canada, because they're not just reliant on the US, they're reliant on other parts of the country, and including having built quite strong ties to the African continent. And the BRICS, the growing BRICS grouping, can definitely see this as an opportunity to strike back at the US, both in terms of the kind of leverage for where trade is happening, but also where production is happening. And I think Africa would be seen as a place to turn to in the face of the US making it increasingly difficult to trade.
So basically you're saying this could be a blessing in disguise, but really can Africa sort of go toe-to-toe or try to compete with the US in any way?
I don't think that we necessarily know there's going to be a blessing in disguise. The problem with African countries is that we are often on the back foot, whether it's coming from the West or the East. We are often at the mercy of the ways in which other players and other economic giants choose to deal with us. And so I'm not sure that we can say with confidence that we know that a turn towards strengthening BRICS relations and trade with Africa or manufacturing Africa will necessarily benefit us, because it depends on what the terms of that is and how it is that African countries show up. But what it does signal is that there will definitely be opportunities for engagement, opportunities for reimagining some economic trading patterns that we've seen. And I think that the US is definitely underestimating the power of the new kind of economic trading blocks. I think even in terms of the EU, The EU has options, and Africa is part of the EU's options as well.
So do we have any idea what incoming President Trump's plans for the African continent are?
No, we don't. And having spoken to people in the U.S. Embassy in South Africa, they don't seem to know either. I think that what we saw in the Trump administration do in the first term is very much ignore Africa for the most part. And I mean, I think of it from the lens of South Africa, that there wasn't real thought put into, you know, what the U.S.'s posture towards the African continent would be. And I don't think that there's any signal that that will change in this second term. I think one of the things that though will be of concern for Africans in the Trump administration almost immediately are questions around the immigration changes that the Trump administration are proposing. And I think that, or at least have threatened to do during the campaign, I think the African immigration patterns, both in terms of studies and doing business and immigrating to the US, I think that's going to possibly be impacted by the way the Trump administration approaches immigration, but it won't be targeted, I think, at Africa in particular. But I do think that African citizens and African countries will feel that impact.
What kind of impact could that be?
So just making it much more difficult for people to study in the U.S., to work in the U.S., to trade in the U.S. I think just getting visas to the U.S. may become a lot more challenging for Africans in the next decade.
And why is that a problem?
I mean, it's a problem because the ability to tap into the learning opportunities, the resources that are, you know, in the U.S. and elsewhere, I think is important for a lot of people who are looking at how do they increase their own reach, their own social capital, tap into global opportunities. The continent is quite limiting for many people when it comes to the kind of opportunities that are on offer. And many people are looking to the opportunity to immigrate in some cases, but particularly for studies and business. Businesses that are linked into some of the US's big spaces like tech, the science spaces, the pharmaceuticals, all of those things. I think the financial sector particularly, I think that just limits those kinds of opportunities for African people who have made a lot of the way that we build our lives and our social and economic opportunities on the back of being able to access other markets and other spaces.
Right. So, Isaac, let me come to you. We've heard from Tessa. So Tessa is being a bit optimistic overall, saying that some of the challenges that can be expected in 2025 could also create opportunities for, you know, Africa to look within itself, look at other, you know, groups that it belongs to, like BRICS, and you know, basically try to make the situation better. But let's look at Ghana, one of the top countries on the continent, democracy-wise, you know, generally quite strong economy. But for a while now, Ghana has experienced, you know, arguably its worst economic situation in decades, right? But there's a new sheriff in town. Well, he was former president. Now he's president-elect, John Mahama. And he overwhelmingly won this particular election. Is he the savior for Ghana? You know, and what does it mean if Ghana gets back on track economically?
Well, for many people, if you talk to them in Ghana, it's not like the former president coming really was, let's say, I mean, there was no obviously option for many Ghanaians. You have two leading candidates, two leading political parties, and it appears that people just were not happy with the current political party that has been in power. And so this is like a verdict on their performance, but also saying perhaps we're not expecting the former president to come and take us to heaven, but perhaps to slow the pace at which they thought the country was descending into the abyss. And so basically that is what you will see is the current status quo And so you don't expect, and if you talk to people, they're not expecting him to save the country. I mean, because everybody knows that the country is not currently under an IMF program. And so it means that we have serious economic issues. And so perhaps they're not expecting things to change overnight, but they expect that there could be some kind of slowness in terms of how the country was descending. And they hope that as a former president, he'll hit the ground running. He'll be a better option than the current government, because again, he has been in power before. So if you ask people, he's not a savior necessarily, but they just think that he could do a better job.
Okay, which obviously only time will tell. What is also making headlines in Ghana is the expectation that in 2025, you know, there's going to be the implementation of a visa-free entry policy for all African nationals. I mean, this is not the first time an African country is doing that. According to current research, Ghana only becomes the fifth African country to introduce such a measure. How have Ghanaians been reacting to this initiative, and what impact could it have both on Ghana and the continent as a whole?
Well, funny enough, people thought that the current president only did this just perhaps for political expediency, or just to say, I did it before I left power, because ideally they thought, well, why couldn't you wait? You just have a few days to go. Why won't you wait for the new president to decide whether that's the way to go? But to the largest extent, I think many Ghanaians don't have an issue really with this. They will love that once there's visa free for all African countries, obviously Ghana will have the same reciprocal approach, or let's say action being taken for them, so they can also have that particular benefit. So it's not really a big deal, but in the context of Pan-Africanism, it's long overdue. Ghana should have done this long ago. And so, yes, it's better late than never. And I think that many people are happy about this, especially for Africans who want to come to Ghana and perhaps have some little challenges. I know that Ghana in the past has had an instance where people can have visa on arrival, but if it's visa free, it means that it becomes even easier for people to visit the country and go around, yeah.
How would you describe Ghana's role on the continent? You know, in a sense, I'm asking, why is it important for Ghana to succeed?
Because, again, it is a shining light in Africa when it comes to fight for independence, in democracy. It has had stability for some time now. It's really a free country to move around, and you could succeed if you work hard. I think as the country that led that light, with Kwame Nkrumah playing that key role, it is only good that it continues on that trajectory and narrative to inspire others around. And I think that we'll be doing so much disservice to Africa if, based on how the country started, it had to retrogress. I think that we need a good case study for others to learn from. And I think across Africa, if you talk to people, they still pick some lessons from Ghana, especially with Kwame Nkrumah and what he did. It's still an inspiration all these years. And so it is just good that that narrative ends properly so that others can learn from it. Because we need good examples on the continent for people to learn from and to succeed, and also to get to the next level of development, stability, democracy-wise, peace, cordiality, and all those things. Yeah. So Ghana, of course, must. And just not Ghana, I think every country on the continent must succeed so that the continent itself as well, generally together, we succeed.
Right. That brings me straight to you, Tessa, because in the same line, you know, it's important for a continent to succeed, but for it to succeed, individual countries must pull up, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think that we are in a global crisis when it comes to the state of democracy, the state of governance in the world. And I think that Africa is not being spared this. And I think for us, it's a more acute issue around how do we think about governance, democracy going forward, when in countries that have been the epitome of democracy around the world, the Germanys, the Frances, the USA are themselves questioning why their democracies are producing the kind of outcomes, the kind of leaders that it is at the moment, and why there's a general disgruntlement about democracy, even in places where at a development level, democracy is delivering better than it does on the African continent. And so for us, we suffer the problem that when democracy has failed, it's been very clear that it's been failing. But the problem is when democracy on paper has succeeded, and Ghana is a good example of this, South Africa is a good example of this, where when you look on the metrics of what makes a functional democracy, our countries meet those, but are not delivering on the economic and development indicators for the majority of people. And that gives democracy a bad name, a worse name than in the case of a country where there's been a dictator for many years, or where there's been military coups, because then you don't blame democracy for the retrogressive patterns or for, you know, the non-delivery of services. But in cases where it is working, especially a country like South Africa, which is lauded not only for the transition that we had, but also for the constitution that we have, when democracy's outcomes are not for the majority of people, that causes an issue. And I do think that as Africans, we need to take some serious stock about where we are, where our countries are, what is working, what is not, and why is it not working, so that we can contribute to the broader global conversation about the future of democracy, which has a conversation that is starting everywhere else. But we can do it from a uniquely African perspective, one that says that, you know, there are certain things about the ways in which we're practicing and building democratic institutions that are just not fit for purpose for the kinds of societies that we have in our context. And we need to then reflect on, you know, if we believe in democracy, how do we build democracies that are fit for purpose in Africa and deliver for the people of Africa rather than just deliver for a few or deliver in the eyes of, you know, the global West, the global North, and so forth.
Right, right. I mean, it's an ongoing debate, democracy and its impact on the economy. You know, how do people feel the effect of democracy in their pockets? And that is definitely one of the challenges that many African countries are facing. I mean, all the discussion that we're having now is aimed at looking at how Africa positions itself or repositions itself in 2025, you know, bearing in mind the challenges that many countries on the continent face. In your submission, you talked about Germany. That is Europe's largest economy. Well, Germany is having elections in February. What impact could a new chancellor, possibly a new chancellor, have on Germany-Africa relations?
Well, I think the German elections and the fast-tracking of those elections and moving them up is probably more impactful than, you know, who might win is, because it does speak to a global trend, again, around what we're calling anti-establishment politics, where particularly unorthodox politics, unorthodox parties, right-wing populist parties are gaining a lot of traction, are able to create the kind of instability that we've seen in Germany. And I think that that's one of the things that will have an indirect, I think, effect on the continent. And we have to figure out if that will be for better or for worse. I think in the context of Europe, that where we've seen anti-establishment politics on the uptake, it has generally been right-wing politics, extremist politics, nationalist politics. But in the African context, the question is, can we build a anti-establishment politics that calls out the establishment and calls out the weaknesses in democracy, in global capitalism, et cetera, but doesn't veer towards the kind of things that we are seeing in Europe and are likely to see if the German population does vote more towards the right, which is what this election is going to be about for Germany. Does Germany go towards a more nationalist, populist, right-wing, anti-immigrant, anti-liberal values direction or not? And I think the two parts to that coin is, will Africa take its lead from Europe going more towards the right, or will we take our lead from Europe in terms of anti-establishment politics that looks different, perhaps? And I think we've got a lot to consider in that regard. We've seen, for example, in the Botswana case, where that was clearly an anti-establishment change election. But it wasn't, and it doesn't seem to be one that is driven by kind of the right-wing agenda that we're seeing in Europe. And that's a good thing and a good signal and a good sign. But in terms of whether or not an incumbent government in Germany will change relations with Africa, I think it would if the extreme right gets a lot more power than it has right now, not only because of Africa-German relations directly, and the way in which that might change Germany's outlook towards Africa and trade with Africa, but also in terms of the role that Germany will have in terms of pushing the EU in various directions when it comes to that. So I do think it's something to look out for, because I think if a right-wing government does emerge there, it will have implications for a different outlook towards Africa that is not necessarily as favorable.
Kaleji, John Mahama, again, has been president before. He is going to be president again after being sworn in on the 7th of January. Based on his previous policies, you know, opening Ghana up to the rest of the world and his relations with Germany, the European Union, what can we expect from Ghana's relations to the rest of the world?
No, I think John Mahama largely is an Nkrumah, is someone who believes in Pan-Africanism and opening up the country to the rest of the world. I mean, he understands that diplomacy and the importance. And you can even see it right before even his swearing in. He's actually going around the continent, meeting presidents who he will say are friends and he knows them and all that. So I think there won't be any change in terms of either retrogressing, but perhaps taking it to the next level. But again, because he has been president before and he knows some of these things and how the whole African Union works, the ECOWAS works, and he has played key roles even after he lost elections in 2016. So we are going to see that actually continuing. And I think that his experience in that regard to make gains in that respect. So I don't think that we are going to expect anything that will be counterproductive to Ghana and also Africa, but perhaps will be progressive in nature.
Tessa, there is no doubt that without unity among African countries, that could impact the way the continent overall can sort of re-strategize and have a new sort of look in 2025. That could be a challenge if countries are not united and on the same page, can't it?
Well, I think yes and no. I think, again, this period that we've entered into in history is one where there's going to be a lot more contestation than there is going to be agreement. Contestation on things that people have assumed as fundamental and unnegotiable, uncontestable. The nature of democracy, the nature of governance. The Sahel regions prove that contestation is a real one. And I think that especially as new African leaders are emerging, that actually is a healthy thing. It's a healthy thing for there to be internal debate and internal discussion and internal push and pull around what is the right fit for Africa, for its different sub-regions. The problem comes in when there's a divide and rule strategy in terms of external interests from the continent. And I think that has been Africa's chronic problem, is managing external global interests and the impact of that, not only on the economy, but particularly on governance and the politics of the continent. And so, I mean, even the Sahel region is not, it's shaking off the French, but it can't just shake off the French without the shaking the hands of others. And so it is also courting new global interests. We spoke earlier about China, and China's influence on the continent has been through a number of bilateral engagements with different role players on the continent, different countries on the continent. And you haven't seen a strong AU stance, for example, when it comes to how to approach BRICS, how to approach China and China's growing influence, how to approach the US the last 5 years or so have seen a decline in the role of the AU almost entirely. It's actually been quite worrying.
Let's be optimistic. 2025 is here. Tessa Dooms, sociologist, development practitioner, and political analyst. Thank you very much. Also, DW correspondent in Accra, Ghana, Isaac Kaleji. Thank you very much, guys, for your insights.
Africa is changing. Don't get left behind. Tune in to Africa Link.
As we conclude, it's clear that the African Union and other regional bodies have a crucial role to play in shaping Africa's future. By developing a coordinated approach to engage with the rest of the world on key issues, the continent can reduce its dependency on any single global power and navigate the challenges and opportunities of 2025. What do you think? Join the conversation on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. Don't forget to click follow so you never miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW News.
This is Mimi Mefone with the DW News. The presidents of Senegal and Ivory Coast announced the withdrawal of French troops from their countries, marking further reductions in France's military presence in West Africa. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara stated that the pullout, involving up to 600 French troops, will begin in January with the Port-Bouët military base handed over to Ivorian forces. Senegalese President Bassirou Diomaye Faye confirmed that all foreign military presence in Senegal would end by 2025, following his earlier directive for the closure of French bases. This development reflects a broader trend, as France has faced similar expulsions from Chad, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso in recent years. In Nigeria, President Bola Tinubu in his New Year address pledged to boost food production and reduce inflation on essential items to 15% while strengthening the economy in 2025. He announced the establishment of the National Credit Guarantee Company to expand risk-sharing instruments for financial institutions and enterprises. Cameroon's 91-year-old President Paul Biya expressed gratitude for the nation's continued support and reaffirmed his commitment to serving the country. In his New Year address, he announced the recruitment of 9,944 health workers over the next 5 years to improve healthcare and reduce unemployment among young people in the sector. As 2025 is an election year, it remains unclear whether Biya would seek re-election. And in Guinea, the transitional president general Mamadi Doumbouya outlined plans to restore constitutional order in 2025. His New Year address detailed a roadmap including a constitutional referendum in early 2025, followed by presidential, legislative, and local elections. He emphasized that a new constitution tailored to Guinea's needs would end the transition period accompanied by a new election. You're listening to the news on Africa Link, brought to you by DW. Burkina Faso's transitional parliament has passed a law granting amnesty to soldiers involved in a failed coup in 2015. The coup, led by soldiers loyal to ousted President Blaise Compaoré, aimed to overthrow the transitional government before elections but thwarted by military opposition. High-ranking officers convicted in 2019 can now appeal for clemency by writing to Army General Captain Ibrahim Traoré. Compaoré, whom the coup sought to reinstate, had fled the country in 2014 after protests against his attempt to extend his 27-year rule. And finally, Romania and Bulgaria joined the EU's Schengen Free Travel Area on Wednesday, scrapping land border controls. While air and sea checks were lifted in March 2024, land checks continued until Austria dropped its veto last month. Schengen now includes 25 EU countries and 4 non-EU nations. That's the recap of today's major headlines. Thank you for listening. Wishing you all a healthy and prosperous new year. My name is Mimi Mefone.
DW. Made for Minds.